Our auditorium class, we are continuing in Isaiah. If you'll be turning to chapter 13, we will start what is the next main section of the book. And we noted the first six chapters are something of an introduction, and then we get this section from chapter 13 through 35 that we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks, that God is the master, the Lord, the sovereign of the nations. And that section is bracketed with two historical events, how Ahaz attempted to deal with the threat to his kingdom, which came at the hands of an alliance between the Arameans and the Israelites. And he failed to trust the Lord and put his trust instead of Assyria, who turns around to be the enemy. And then Ahaz's son Hezekiah, at the end, we see how he deals with the Assyrian problem, and in some ways having to deal with the mess his father created for him. And he trusts in the Lord, and even though there are still a lot of consequences to Judah having trusted in Assyria, the Lord does deliver his people. So what we're going to explore then in chapters 13 through 35 is this question of where we put our trust. Do we trust in the Lord, or do we put our trust in the nations of the earth? And of course, that's just really representative of putting your trust in the power of man, in the wisdom of man. And so, once again, even though we may not be facing the particular historical situation, the people of Judah, you know, we don't have to deal with the Assyrian Empire threatening to invade us or anything like that. But it's the same basic story of the Bible. Do we trust God, or do we trust in our own strength, our own solution to our own problems, that kind of thing. So, looking at this section a little bit more detailed, chapters 13 through 23 are a series of oracles that are pronounced against various nations, and we'll look at a list of those here in a minute. One term that frequently occurs in this section is the word oracle, or what literally is the Hebrew word for burden, apparently being the idea that the prophet has been given this burden to carry about this particular nation or that nation, and therefore most of the English versions will translate that as an oracle pronounced in regard to that particular nation. Chapters 24 through 27 are something of a summation of the sovereignty that God has over the nations of the earth. Not any one nation in particular. It's kind of a grandiose section. One could even, reading these chapters, think it's talking about the final state of God's victory over all the nations of the earth. And of course, in a sense, it does point to that. But there would also be a more immediate application of that as God demonstrates his sovereignty over the nations. Not just at the final day of judgment, but throughout human history, he does that. Chapters 28 through 33 continue this focus upon the various nations of the earth, but the particular emphasis of this section will be demonstrating just how foolish it is for God's people in particular to put their trust in these various nations. Now, some of this, I expect, for us will begin to seem a little bit repetitive. The number of oracles, for example, that Isaiah has to pronounce against the Egyptians. The problem is the Egyptians were a real temptation to the people of Judah. They represent this great world power. If we just ally ourselves with them, they'll loan us armies and support, and that's what we need to deal with the Assyrians or somebody else. And it's just the same problem over and over again. So you just wind up asking the question, how many times does God have to hit the people of Judah over the head with a stick saying, don't do this, you know? But once again, you look at yourself in humility and you say, well, how many times have I done the same stupid thing over and over again? How many times does God have to tell me to stop doing that? So there will be some similar themes that come up again, you know, about the Egyptians and so on. But as I've said, the particular point here is, therefore, don't trust in them. Don't put your hope and confidence in those things. It'll let you down. And then at the very end, the last two chapters of this section basically present us with a choice. We can choose a desert or we can choose a garden. That's the two images that are used in these two chapters. If you put your trust in God, life is like a garden. If you put your trust in these nations, you've chosen devastation and destruction. And of course, that's an appropriate ending because it's then in chapters 36 through 39, that's the choice Hezekiah faces. Will he choose the desert or the garden? Will he choose the Lord or the nations? Will he put his trust in himself, in his own wisdom, and the strength of men and human armies? Or will he put that in God? Now, it's going to be a while before we get there. We're going to be looking in this section of the various judgments of the nations, chapters 13 through 23. So, looking at that a little bit more in detail, here are a series of these judgments that are coming, and giving you some idea at least of where I think he's going with this and why he put them together the way he did. In other words, I don't think Isaiah just sat there saying, okay, what's a bad nation? Oh, the Moabites. Yeah, I'm going to say something about the Moabites. And then let me think, the Philistines. Yeah, they're bad too. And, Egypt. Yeah, I need to put them down. There is a kind of orderliness to how he goes through this that we'll look at. We'll look at chapters 13 and 14 here, particularly this morning on the Babylonians. And then the next several ones you might summarize as being Judah's neighbors, the Moabites and the Philistines and so on. And again, the point here is that in Judah dealing with her political problems, had a tendency to want to make alliances with these nations around them and to depend upon that for solving many of her problems. And then middle of chapter 17 through 18, we get this section. It's not described as an oracle against anyone. Doesn't appear to be addressed specifically against any particular nation. Now, some people's outlines will say, it's an oracle against Ethiopia or something like that. We'll explore that when we look at that section later. But I've called it here an interlude, exalting the sovereignty of Yahweh again over the nations of the earth. And then we get a section particularly on Egypt, which if you thought Judah was inclined to make alliances with her neighbors, these little petty kingdoms around her, that's true. But the real temptation was to make an alliance with the Egyptians and depend upon Egypt for strength to counter any great opponent coming out of the Mesopotamia like the Assyrians. and then this will lead into a section of oracles that are not announced against any particular nation, but they're called, there's an oracle of the wilderness of the sea and the valley of vision and things like this. And what it is envisioning is, beginning all the way over in Babylon, right up to the doorstep of Jerusalem, is just the Assyrian army just relentlessly marching closer and closer to Judah. And every nation that tries to stand against it falls. And of course, the Babylonians tried to rebel against their Assyrian overlords. And they're trying to make all these alliances and deals with people to help support their revolt. And obviously, that is probably the best way to understand this Babylonian embassy that came to Hezekiah. You remember? And how Isaiah was so upset with him. And, as a kid, I remember reading that story and thinking, well, what's the big deal? Isaiah's just being a nice, host, people come to your house and you say, well, let me show you around, here's where the bathroom is, here's the dining room, and we don't feel like we're doing anything particularly evil, doing that. What's so big deal about Hezekiah going around saying, let me show you around my kingdom? But I think there was more to it than that the Babylonians weren't just touring, the Middle East. Oh, let's go see what's in Jerusalem. I hear they got some nice things there. They were interested in forming alliances to bolster their power against the Assyrians, and the fact that Hezekiah would receive them is something of a suggestion of where his mind was leaning, and Isaiah warns him about that. But be that as it may, we'll deal with that when we get that whole section. And then finally, chapter 23 is an oracle against Tyre, which deals with its economic power particularly, that you can wield economic power in such a way to abuse other people and so on. You know, taking over other nations by armies and shooting people isn't the only way to use coercion and so on in the world. Now you notice I put Babylon and Tyre in quotation marks because I don't really think Isaiah is as concerned about literal Tyre or Babylon as he is how they are representative of the bigger powers that be. And it's appropriate to begin and end this section with Babylon and Tyre. One thing they have in common is Babylon is the great world city on the east side of the known world. Tyre is the great world city on the west side. And so this is the Hebrews' world that they have to deal with. And, you know, from one side to the other, God's sovereignty, of course, will extend over all of that. Also, these two cities represent the two great things people are always interested in, money and power, or power as manifest through physical means like military strength, and power as affected through monetary strength. And so these two become good representatives of that that bracket this section. And they represent really the highlight of what every nation is after. Now, you might be a little small nation like the Moabites, but that's what they want. They want money and power. Now, they may be more realistic and accept what they can get, but what everybody wants is money and power and all the things that that will bring, the security that brings and the comfort, you know, pleasure that brings. And so it really doesn't matter who the nations are. That's the point of all this. It's any effort of man that is rooted in his human pride and leaves God out of the equation comes under God's judgment. And here are typical nations that are representative of that very thing. And one question we might ask ourselves is this section really about God's judgment against the nations as much as it is about God's salvation of Israel? You know, so is the focus really God's just in the condemning business? Down with the Egyptians, down with the Babylonians, down with the Moabites, you know. Or is it really rather the focus is on God's deliverance of his people? Because those two things go hand in hand. And God has created reality a certain way in which he says, true life only comes by trusting in me. And those who reject that have chosen destruction for themselves. And the significance of looking at the focus this way is the message that Isaiah has is not so much for these foreign nations. Now, I suspect God in his providence probably had some way of getting the message out to the Babylonians or the people of Tyre, Egypt. You know, there are many examples of Israelite prophets who have messages for foreign nations. But first and foremost, these messages are for God's own people. They need to know that these nations of the earth that put their confidence in themselves rather than in God come under judgment. And the message is really more for you. What does that mean for you? You need to understand this principle so that you need to put your trust in the Lord and not in yourself. That's the real message that Isaiah has for the people of his day. And so that which we all want, permanence, security, life, those are all wonderful things. The question is, how do you get them? You do not get them if I just had a bigger army, I'd be more secure, I'd be more permanent, we'd make a lasting name on the earth, we'll have a 1,000-year Reich, you know. No, not going to happen. But if you put your trust in God, that's the only permanence and security in life that you're going to find. Now, one other thing I might mention about Tyre being really a representative city, not only is the language of chapter 23 suggestive of that fact, but when we get to the book of Revelation, you remember there's one of these cities that is used by God as he's revealing this vision through John, this great world empire that's exalted against God's people that comes under God's judgment. And who is that? Well, they're mentioned in the book, but the one that's predominantly mentioned is the Babylon. Babylon the Great, you know, has fallen and so on. But when you get to chapter 17 and Babylon is described, Most of the references in Revelation 17 are taken from what chapter? Chapter 23 here of Isaiah. The description of Tyre is transferred and applied to Babylon in the book of Revelation. And a couple of other places where Tyre is referred to in the Old Testament as well. So I find that very telling. And again, it's indicative of the fact that it's really a mistake to just say, oh, here was a prediction. Isaiah looked in his crystal ball and he said, well, looky there. The Babylonians are going to have something bad done to them by God. Isn't that amazing? That's not really the point. That all nations that leave God out of the equation will come under a judgment. And these are models and types of God's judgment. And anyone that imitates this process is going to find the same result being worked out in their lives as well. Shane, did you have
I don't think it would be important for people of that day to understand that God was giving these kingdoms their advancements, the things that were happening from a good standpoint. Because I'm sure the Assyrians thought that whatever God they served was giving them the victories, was giving them the growth.
Right. I think it's a good point that the good things these nations experience are God's blessing, and in fact, when it comes to God's judgment, the primary thing He judges them for is, if you had to boil it down to main thing, okay, misusing the blessings, failing to be grateful to God and understanding why they had these blessings, and maybe taking credit for it themselves rather than thanking God for it. And again, pride, is a good way of summing up all of that. Look how great I am. Look at all that I can do. And rather than humbly being grateful to God for what He has done for us. Now here's another thing we might consider as we look at the big picture of this section. Why start with the Babylonians? Babylon as a world empire does not exist. They're simply one small state under the control of the Assyrian Empire at the time that Isaiah lives. Now, they were probably the most powerful state under the control of the Assyrians, and the one that was always trying to break free and get their independence back. And of course, they had the Babylonian Empire some years before that. Most of you may have heard of Hammurabi and his law codes and so on. Well, back in that time period, which is, about 1800 B.C. or so. So the Babylonians had a history of being a great world empire. And certainly a lot of people longed to go back to those glory days. And we even had a recent experience with that here in modern history. Saddam Hussein wanted to, reclaim the glory days of the Babylonian Empire. Under his rule. Well, but the historical situation being what it is, they find themselves under the control of the Assyrians, under the domination of their neighbors to the north, and so they're always trying to break free and things like that and get some independence. And they eventually will do that, and they will overthrow the Assyrians and take over. And that's why the Assyrians are the world empire that's in charge at the time when God brings judgment against the northern kingdom of Israel and carts them off into captivity. And then, 100 years later, when it comes time for Judah to be carried off into captivity, it's no longer the Assyrians but the Babylonians instead that are the instrument of God's punishment. Well, that raises the question again, why does Isaiah start with Babylon? And of course, the modernist person says, well, of course, Isaiah didn't write this. It was somebody who lived after the time of the Babylonians, and when the Babylonians had carted off the southern kingdom of Judah, they made up these prophecies and said, oh, yeah, those bad Babylonians, they're going to do bad things to God's people, but they're going to get theirs, of course, if you believe in legitimate prophecy, I guess the answer could be, well, God just knew the Babylonians were going to be an even bigger problem for Judah than the Assyrians were. But even that, I think, misses the point ultimately. And of course, I've preached on this before, so you know, I've probably already told you what I think about this. But you know, way back in the beginning in Genesis, we had the first world city, you know, that exalts itself against God. We're going to be somebody, and we're going to build this tower, and we're going to build this city, lest we be dispersed over the face of the earth. And the people who put their confidence in their ability to pool their resources together and their strength, their wisdom, their economic power, and so on, will really be somebody. And God came down and put an end to that whole enterprise. Well, that was the Tower of Babylon. And it really doesn't matter what name you put on the city, it's that same spirit of Babylon that has existed in every age. It always will until the final day of judgment when God finally puts an end to the whole thing. And so I think the point that Isaiah is making here is this Babylon has always been with us. It'll always be with us until it comes under final and complete extermination by God, which will happen on a final day of judgment. But until then, we need to realize we have this problem with Babylon. Even more importantly, we need to understand we have this yearning for Babylon within our heart. I mean, if you look at the situation today, you say, well, who's the great world power Babylon today? And some people would quickly say the United States. Others would say, oh, China's coming on, or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, nobody is quite like, you know, the Roman Empire or the Babylon Empire, the Assyrian Empire. No one is wielding the kind of cruel, just brute strength and so on that you see with a lot of these kingdoms in the Bible. But again, I think we still need to pause and consider the issue. However, you know, in my own life, do I suffer from this temptation, this tendency to want to find comfort in strength of numbers, you know? In other words, you know, you look at some people and they go looking for a church. I want to be a church that's got, you know, 800 members. I want to be a church that's got 10,000 members or whatever. It's a big group, you know. And the bigger it is, the more it's obviously blessed by God. And if you got some small group, well, obviously they can't be a faithful church. Well, in some ways, I'm not saying just paint everybody with a broad brush here. Anybody that's got more than, you know, 52 members is a sinful church. But there is that spirit of Babylon that is present a lot of times in that. That bigger is better. We're trying to build some monument to human pride. Look what we have done. Look what we have accomplished. Look who we are. And whether we ever really build some actual world empire or not is really beside the point. Do we have this same Tower of Babylon mentality about us? We're not content for the church to simply be a group of Christians getting together to encourage one another. We've got to organize, and we've got to, you know, build something elaborate and so on. And so you wind up with these huge denominations and things because, you know, we need to pool our resources together in order to do these great things for God. Well, God doesn't need us to do anything. God can do whatever he wants with or without us. The gospel spread the quickest in the first century without any organized corporations or power structures or big denominational, you know, organizations to accomplish that work. So again, we sometimes buy into this Tower of Babylon mentality. Now, one other example of this I would cite, of course, is in Daniel, which we looked at recently, Daniel chapter 2. You remember the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had, the dream of the image, which he was the head of gold, and, you know, each of these parts represented four successive world empires. But when that little rock grew into a mighty mountain and smashes the image, it smashes the image in its entirety. It's not like the head falls off and the chest falls off. You know, there's a sense in which that whole image is Babylon. And yes, the Persians will be the Babylonians next, and the Greeks will be the Babylonians next, and the Romans will be the Empire of Babylon next. So again, it's the name's being changed, and it's going under new management, but it's the same spirit of Babylon. It's the same Tower of Babylon mentality. And I think that's what really Isaiah is getting at here. that all of these nations are simply applications of the Tower of Babylon mentality. Maybe it'll be Moab, maybe it'll be Philistia, maybe it'll be Egypt, but they all really are still just Babylon. And so what is expressed here, of course, would apply to Babylon specifically, and Babylon, God knew that Babylon would become the great world power that would be the great enemy of Judah, but it also is representative of just that whole mentality and human pride and so on that comes under God's judgment. And so if we read it that way, I think we'll get more out of it, certainly more be able to perceive how relevant it is to our own particular circumstances and so on. And so anyway, that's the approach I'm going to be taking to see, you know, actual fulfillment. I mean, when Isaiah says in chapters 19 and 20, don't put your trust in Egypt, he is saying, yes, literal Egypt is a temptation that you want to make an alliance with and depend upon them to help you dealing with the Assyrians. Don't do that. But again, if that's all it is to us, then pretty much we'll get at the end of it and say, well, why did we really need to study that? I don't think any of us are going to run out and make an alliance with Egypt anytime soon politically. But no, there's still principles here that we learn spiritually. What does Egypt represent? And what would it mean for us to put our trust in Egypt and so on? So we'll think about those things as you read through this and think about what kind of practical application you might make. And I think it'll be eye-opening to you in a lot of ways. All right, well, I'll pause here and see if you have any observations of your own of a general nature. Barry?
I appreciate your observation of Babylon being throughout all history. I think that's really interesting, and I don't think we necessarily apply it like we were just talking about applying it today. And looking at some of these, I'm going to just say world religions, you know, how they become bigger and bigger. I'm not going to offend anybody, but Catholicism is a great example of that building up a big organization and almost world domination in order to show that it is bigger and better than anything else in the world. But it also, in that effort, also achieved, you know, taking the name of Christ out into the world, whether it did it badly or however it did it. It did accomplish a huge service there in one respect, and I don't know exactly what I'm getting at, but I see a parallel there.
Sure.
Well,
God can use means to accomplish. He can bring good out of anything. That doesn't justify, you know, its existence, for example, or its intent, but it does demonstrate God. God has always worked in the affairs of man and used various nations according to his purpose. Lawson?
Following up Barry's comments, you read Revelation, you get a lot of hints about Rome.
Well, and certainly a lot of people have even interpreted it as, you know, about the new Roman Empire, I guess you might say, or something. But again, and I think not necessarily that when John wrote Revelation, that he may have been explicitly meaning that, but that's really beside the point. What principles do we see here? And if the shoe fits, you know, we need to make application of it. And but again, more importantly, I think when we look at these judgments against nations, the temptation for us a lot of times might be, well, I'm not a nation, so what does it mean to me? But there is individual application of this as well. And of course, we do need to keep in mind our own, you know, we are citizens of a nation, and God has expectations of nations as well, and holds us to be morally responsible for what we do or what we fail to do, the evil that we do, the good that we fail to do. There is a national degree of responsibility that we bear, even if we individually may not be responsible. I mean, abortion is a classic example. Our nation is guilty of abortion. I personally am not guilty of abortion. I've never done anything to advocate or support it, but have I done enough to oppose it? I can never know that for sure, and so I may still bear some individual guilt and responsibility. God may still hold me to some extent accountable, because on the day of judgment, he may very well say, you didn't do enough. But again, collectively, nationally, we bear responsibility. And then individually, again, we need to consider our responsibility as well. All right, well, let's look at chapters 13 and 14. We'll try to get through these two chapters. And then try to get through at least the next two sections there through chapter 18 to make it down to chapter 19 to the Egyptians. I don't expect we will want to spend a lot of time looking at these various oracles against nations, and pretty soon one nation will start looking like another nation, and especially if we're not geographically interested in these, the Moabites and Philistines, you know, one man's Medes, another man's Persian. So, well, what's the, significance to us? Well, now one thing we might say, of course, about chapter 13 and 14, these chapters are often interpreted as being about what? Particularly Lucifer, you've fallen out of the sky, and well, I think that's what it's about. But a lot of people say it's the fall of the devil, right? I mean, that's where we get the name Lucifer as a common name that people use for the devil. Yet, I think very clearly when you start chapter 13 here, it says the oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw. So that's pretty clear. It's about Babylon. Now, I can say it's more than just about literal Babylon. It is representative. It's typical. It's a model of other nations as well, and I think that would be appropriate. And I suppose you could even say that perhaps Isaiah modeled the fall of Babylon after the fall of Satan. But I don't know how you would know that. But certainly, when it comes to the devil, we would have to conclude just philosophically, whether the Bible said one word about this or not, Satan is a created being, and he did sin in some way. God didn't create him evil. He chose to be. So he would have to be a fallen spirit being of some kind. So when you find references to that in the Bible, oh, that's the devil. Well, maybe, maybe not. But here it appears that what Isaiah is doing is saying, you, the king of Babylon, and probably not just personally the literal king of Babylon, but, the representative of all of the might of Babylon focused in this, the one who's leading it, you thought you were really somebody. You were up there with God, but how you've fallen and been cast down. Well, again, we'll say, oh, yeah, they say it does sound like Satan. Well, but it's the principle, how arrogance and pride exalts someone, but God will bring them down in judgment. So let's notice the first 18 verses here, which is God's intention to destroy human pride. Lift up a standard on the bare hill, raise your voice to them, wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I've commanded my consecrated ones. I've even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people, a sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering the army for battle. They're coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons. The Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. So God's getting his army together. That's the basic point of all that. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. And really the whole section here could be summarized in that one verse. The day of the Lord is coming. And of course, we've talked about this day of the Lord many times. It occurs most often in the book of Joel. It is a day. It's not one particular day. There have been many days of the Lord, days upon which God comes in judgment. And it always does two things. It brings judgment against the ungodly, the unrighteous, and it brings deliverance for those who put their trust in the Lord. And here the focus, of course, is on judgment. The day of the Lord, when it comes to the Babylonians, will be a day of destruction, therefore you need to wail. All hands will fall limp, every man's heart will melt, they will be terrified, pains and anguish will take hold of them, they'll writhe like a woman in labor, they will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellation will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises. The moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold and make mankind scarcer than the gold of Ophir. And therefore I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts and the day of his burning anger. And it'll be like that of a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them. They will each turn to his own people, each one flee to his own land. Anyone who's found will be thrust through, and anyone who's captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered, their wives ravished. I'm going to stir up the Medes against them, who do not value silver or take pleasure in gold. Their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, or will their eye pity children. He says he'll raise up the Medes. This is kind of a perennial enemy of the Babylonians. And it's like they just will destroy for the pleasure of it. They don't really care even about the money. They just do it for the fun of it. But God will use them to bring about this destruction. Well, there's a lot to be learned here about the day of the Lord and God's judgment of the wicked and so on. Very graphic image here. I think the most important thing we can take away from this is you see the prophetic language that's used. The sun will not shine its light. The moon will not. The stars will fall out of the sky. And if you're looking for some physical fulfillment of this, you'd say, well, it never happened. Isaiah's prophecy is still waiting to be fulfilled. But that's not the way it's intended. They're figures that describe what it would be. What would the downfall of Babylon be like? Well, to the Babylonians, it's the end of the world. And we even talk about, you know, punching somebody's lights out. Well, how does striking them in the face affect their electric bill? Well, it's not a literal statement. It is a figure. And God's putting the lights out of the nations here. And it's going to be such a catastrophic judgment that it will be the end for them. And so, again, you see the emphasis upon arrogance and pride there. And this is applied to Babylon specifically now at the end of chapter 13. Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, or shepherds make their flocks lie down. Desert creatures will live there, and you get a catalog of different, you know, creatures living there because it's not inhabited anymore. And so then, notice chapter 14. Here's the taunt against the king of Babylon. The first few verses of chapter 14, the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and settle them in their land. This again looks forward to the time when people will come back from Babylonian captivity. But in the day when the Lord gives you rest, he says in verse 3, then in verse 4, you'll take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. How has the oppressor ceased, and how fury has ended? The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. The whole earth is at rest in quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you. And the cedars of Lebanon saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. You know, the axeman who comes and cuts trees down. Well, even the trees are spared from the destruction wreaked by the Babylonians. Verse 9, Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. You know, you just picture the underworld getting all ready to receive the king of Babylon. Now we're going to roll out the red carpet. King of Babylon's coming. Can you just imagine what is it like for a king to die and go to the realm of the dead? You think he's going to be living in glory and luxury and all? No, the dead are all equal. And so the kings of the earth that are in Sheol who've died, they're pictured as sitting on their thrones in Sheol, and they stand in homage to the king of Babylon when he comes in, and they will all respond and say, even you have been made weak as we. You've become like us. Your pomp and music of your harps has been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. You know, death is the end of it all for you. And so, how you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of dawn, you've been cut down to earth. You have weakened the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I'll raise my throne above the stars of God. I'll set on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. But nevertheless, again, you're cut down, thrust down to Sheol, the recesses of the pit. And it's just going to be a marvel. Everybody's going to look and say, how did this happen? The one who, you know, just to sneeze and the world shook, he had such power. And now look what he is. He's just this rotting corpse in a pit. And that's what God can do, and how far God can bring people down. Well, our time is up. Unfortunately, we'll have a few concluding remarks to make at the end of chapter 14, and then try to cover again the next several chapters. So you'll go ahead and read those. And in particular, if you have a question over some particular part, you know, make a note of that. So we're not going to obviously read through the whole section and comment on all of that, but if you have any particular questions, we'll be glad to answer those as best as we can. So we'll look forward to continuing then next week.